Namaste. So, we come together again tonight on the 11th of October, 2020, to review a chapter that was published on the 15th of October in 1916. The modes of the self appeared in the aria right behind the lead article from the Life Divine, which was The Sevenfold Cord of Being, in which Sri Aurobindo unrolled the map of the cosmos. How is it that the transcendent stations itself at these numerous planes, building up from a basal incantation, so that climbing that stair, one can reach again the realms of the superconscient, the truth of its own being. It has become the universe. It is established in all these planes. So after writing that chapter, which is one of the most wondrous in the Life Divine, he turns to the modes of the self. He never comes back to revise it. This is his one pass at it. And he describes here the intimate relations between and among all three notes of conscious being, as a transcendence, as universal, as an individual. So a cosmic and then a psychological picture of reality in this one issue. If this was the only issue that you owned from all the publications in the aria, this would be one to possess and cherish. So from cosmic being to the ranges of self-being, the modes of the self, chapter 11. Since the self, which we come to realize by the path of knowledge, is not only the reality which lies behind and supports the states and movements of our psychological being, but also that transcendent and universal existence which has manifested itself in all the movements of the universal, the knowledge of the self includes also the knowledge of the principles of being, its fundamental modes, and its relations with the principles of the phenomenal universe. This was what was meant by the Upanishad when it spoke of the Brahman as that which, being known, all is known. He has a footnote here. Yasmin vijñāte sarvam vijñātam. And in the Arya, it's noted as coming from the Prashna Upanishad, the Upanishad of questions. That's been eliminated here because it is not from that Upanishad. It's not, in fact, exactly that in any Upanishad. But in the Mundaka, the chapter 1, section 1, the third verse, it says something like that. Kasmin nu bhagavo vijñāte sarvam idam vijñātam bhavati iti. So it's close. Closer still is Shankara himself, where he says, Yad ekasmin vijñāte sarvam vijñātam bhavati. But Sri Aurobindo, of course, had few volumes with him as he was writing the aria to refer to. So probably he summoned something up from his memory, which is prodigious. In Sanskrit, he not only read the Rig Veda and the Upanishads and the Gita, but he read a great deal of Shankara. So it could be that Shankara, in his commentary on the Mundaka, said this condensation as an aphoristic aside. Sri Aurobindo noted it in his mind, and that's how it arrives here. It is not Yasmin, it is Kasmin. They both mean, essentially, in which. Kasmin or Yasmin. So, just one of these little curiosities that we touch upon as we go. Forgive me. It has to be realized first as the pure principle of existence. Afterwards, says the Upanishad, its essential modes become clear to the soul which realizes it. We may indeed, before realization, try to analyze by the metaphysical reason and even understand intellectually what being is and what the world is, but such metaphysical understanding is not the knowledge. That is the understanding of the principles external. That is an intellectual grasping that makes you a learned person. It makes you a pundit, but it does not make you a realized person. One has to enter into identity with that to know it, as he makes immediately clear. Realization is when you become that, not when you read about it, not when you study about it, not when you lecture about it. You must become that one in your consciousness with that. Otherwise, yoga is incomplete and knowledge is a halfway house. Moreover, we may have the realization in knowledge and vision, but this is incomplete without realization in the entire soul experience and the unity of all our being with that which we realize. So for Sri Aurobindo again, the entirety of the realization means that no part of the being can be left out. It isn't simply that your inner parts psychologically are made one with that, but actually, factually, all the substance of your being in every corridor, in every room, on every floor of the house of being has to vibrate with the recognition of this presence. It must be real. It must be powerful. He has a footnote here. This is the distinction made in the Gita between Sankhya and Yoga. Both are necessary to an integral knowledge. A knowledge that unifies, makes one. It is the science of yoga to know, and the art of yoga to be unified with the highest, so that we may live in the self and act from that supreme poise, becoming one not only in the conscious essence, but in the conscious law of our being with the transcendent divine, whom all things and creatures, whether ignorantly or with partial knowledge and experience, seek to express through the lower law of their members. You might remember the Gita. We've quoted this shloka before. It's in the fourth chapter, verse 9. He who knows in its right principles, tatvataha, my divine birth, divya, and my divine work, comes not to rebirth. That means to ignorance. He comes to me. To know the highest truth and to be in harmony with it is the condition of right being. To express it in all that we are, experience, and do is the condition of right living. But rightly to know and express the highest is not easy for man, the mental being, because the highest truth, and therefore the highest modes of existence, are supramental. And we remember that the Gita, when it makes possible to Arjuna the station of the third, the highest Purusha, the being of the Purushottama, calls him into oneness with that. Transcend the mutability, transcend also the immutability. Transcend the noise, transcend the silence, and come to me, and here, one with me, you will rule all. From a silent core in a noisy universe, singing the rhapsodies that I pour through your voice into the world. A conscious singer of the divine melody. They repose on the essential unity of what seem to the intellect and mind, and are to our mental experience of the world, opposite poles of existence and idea, and therefore irreconcilable opposites and contradictions, but to the supramental experience are complementary aspects of the same truth. We have seen this already in the necessity of realizing the self as at once one and many. For we have to realize each thing and being as that, tat. We have to realize the unity of all as that, both in the unity of some and in the oneness of essence. And we have to realize that, as the transcendent who is beyond all this unity and this multiplicity which we see everywhere, as the two opposite yet companion poles of all existence. For every individual being is the self, the divine, in spite of the outward limitations of the mental and physical form through which it presents itself at the actual moment, in the actual field of space, in the actual succession of circumstances that make up the web of inner state and outward action and event through which we know the individual. So equally, every collectivity, small or great, is each the self. The divine similarly expressing itself in the conditions of this manifestation. We cannot really know any individual or any collectivity if we know it only as it appears inwardly to itself or outwardly to us, but only if we know it as the divine, the one, our own self employing its various essential modes and its occasional circumstances of self-manifestation. The self is the solitary individual, the soul of that. The self is the extension of individuals into society, the soul of society. Each represents in some spatio-temporal location, some possibility of the divine. But always unmask that circumstance. You find that same essential being there. Atma Shakti, the power of the self to express itself as a tiny growing individual, as a more massive but still limited social being, as a cosmos, and never surrendering its transcendence in the doing. so equally every collectivity, small or great, is each the self, the divine, similarly expressing itself in the conditions of this manifestation. Worth hearing again. We cannot really know any individual or any collectivity if we know it only as it appears inwardly to itself or outwardly to us, but only if we know it as the divine, the one, our own self employing its various essential modes and its occasional circumstances of self-manifestation. So when we understand this, can we see friend and enemy as isolated from each other? Can we see division? We must act from the space that we possess and in the way that we are guided, but never from a sense of difference. If you have been given wisdom, you must act wisely. But in blocking, in obstructing, in removing an impediment, you're not allowed to see that circumstance as representing anything other than a movement in formation. What will grow from it? How you meet it, and how you intentionally change it, and how you bring it back into a larger concord is all the quest for the conscious agent working in the world. And you'll do your best at that. And then if the divine puts into your hands a different instrument, you must use it. But first, we work from a sense of oneness and harmony to gain greater harmony. Until we have transformed the habits of our mentality so that it shall live entirely in this knowledge, reconciling all differences in the one, we do not live in the real truth, because we do not live in the real unity. The accomplished sense of unity is not that in which all are regarded as parts of one whole, waves of one sea, but that in which each as well as the all is regarded wholly as the divine, wholly as ourself, in a supreme identity. And yet so complex is the Maya of the infinite, there is a sense in which the view of all as parts of the whole, waves of the sea, or even as in a sense separate entities, becomes a necessary part of the integral truth and the integral knowledge. Yes, in all the divine play, one has to observe the auspicious insistence on the moment. It wants to do this now. Sometimes you're the individual soul, sometimes you're the universal soul, and sometimes you range beyond both and become the transcendent soul. Remember, too, Sri Aurobindo uses the term Maya as the self-measuring aspect of the divine consciousness to render from its infinity some form of itself, some expressed symbol of itself. Nama and Rupa never divide form, never carve out from the being of Sat something that stands apart, simply the manifestation comes forward, more clear, more suggestive, but never apart. For if the self is always one in all, yet we see that for the purposes at least of the cyclic manifestation, it expresses itself in perpetual soul forms which preside over the movements of our personality through the worlds and the eons. This persistent soul existence is the real individuality which stands behind the constant mutations of the thing we call our personality. Well, we won't here, since Sri Aurobindo doesn't, go deeply into the question of what is the nature of the soul essence, what is the jivatman, what is the central being. We've dealt with those topics in other spaces, in other sessions. So we'll move on. It is not a limited ego, but a thing in itself infinite. Thing in itself, Kantian, Dang in sich. And the Dang in sich in Kant's philosophy is beyond the measure of space and time, and so ultimately unknowable. You think you know, you rationalize, you pitch your best to it, but you don't know it, because you cannot. It transcends, and the transcendent can't be known to Kant. For the yogin, absolutely, the transcendent can be known by identity. Kant was a philosopher, not a sage. It is, in truth, the infinite itself consenting from one plane of its being to reflect itself in a perpetual soul experience. And remember, this is how Sankhya works. He's going to reference Sankhya in the next sentence. But the Purusha is always separate from Prakriti. It reflects its consciousness into the play of Prakriti, and thus we presume, taking material, vital, or mental form, that we become said form, when always instead, really, we are the Purusha behind. That is a mere reflection of our reality in that. So Sri Aurobindo's non-duality will not long tolerate this kind of language, but he's used it here to make a rhetorical point. And it's a practical point, too. This is the truth which underlies the Sankhya theory of many Purushas, many essential, infinite, free, and impersonal souls reflecting the movements of a single cosmic energy. Remember, too, the Mundaka Upanishad and its great image of that central fire which throws out millions of sparks, uncountable numbers of sparks, from its essential reality. This is the manifestation from its power of being to seed the universe with these sparks of its own nature. So the Mundaka sees light everywhere and every individuality as essentially the core expression of the divine oneness made multiple. It stands also in a different way behind the very different philosophy of qualified monism, which arose as a protest against the metaphysical excesses of Buddhistic nihilism and illusionist Advaita. The old semi-Buddhistic, semi-Sankhya theory, which saw only the quiescent and nothing else in the world except a constant combination of the five elements and the three modes of inconscient energy, lighting up their false activity by the consciousness of the quiescent in which it is reflected, is not the whole truth of the Brahman. We are not a mere mass of changing mind stuff, life stuff, body stuff, taking different forms of mind and life and body from birth to birth, so that at no time is there any real self or conscious reason of existence behind all the flux, or none except that quiescent who cares for none of these things. There is a real and stable power of our being, the chit, the conscious power of Sat, behind the constant mutation of our mental, vital, and physical personality. And this we have to know and preserve in order that the infinite may manifest himself through it according to his will, in whatever range and for whatever purpose of his eternal cosmic activity. So this is the Shakti of the real being expressing itself as Aishwarya, as the Lord, as the master of the entire process that it populates with its own being. And if we regard existence from the standpoint of the possible eternal and infinite relations of this one from whom all things proceed, these many of whom the one is the essence and the origin, and this energy, power, or nature through which the relations of the one and the many are maintained, we shall see a certain justification even for the dualist philosophies and religions which seem to deny most energetically the unity of beings and to make an unbridgeable differentiation between the Lord and his creatures. If in their grosser forms these religions aim only at the ignorant joys of the lower heavens, yet there is a far higher and profounder sense in which we may appreciate the cry of the devotee poet, when in a homely and vigorous metaphor, he claimed the right of the soul to enjoy forever the ecstasy of its embrace of the Supreme. "I do not want to become sugar," he wrote. "I want to eat sugar." However strongly we may found ourselves on the essential identity of the one self in all, we need not regard that cry as the mere aspiration of a certain kind of spiritual sensuousness or the rejection by an attached and ignorant soul of the pure and high austerity of the Supreme Truth. On the contrary, it aims in its positive part at a deep and mysterious truth of being which no human language can utter, of which human reason can give no adequate account, to which the heart has the key, and which no pride of the soul of knowledge, insisting on its own pure austerity, can abolish. But that belongs properly to the summit of the path of devotion, and there we shall have again to return to it. Can we return to it now for a moment? Here's a quote from the Bhagavad Gita in its closing verses in the 18th chapter. This begins on 55. By devotion, he comes to know me. Who and how much I am, and in all the reality and principles of my being. Having known me, he enters into that, tat, that indescribable absolute beyond Sat and Asat, being and non-being. in which all realities are engulfed. So from that, one can come back, remaining transcendent, donning the supramental principles and ways of being, and conduct oneself flawlessly through the course of the universe on all planes. This, even the Gita, opens a door ajar for us so that we can see what is possible. The Gita does not follow it out, but it is the Bhagavad Gita, the celestial song, which calls us to follow its rapturous voice back to where Krishna is singing to us. There, in the Anandamaya. The sadhaka of an integral yoga will take an integral view of his goal and seek its integral realization. The divine has many essential modes of his eternal self-manifestation, possesses and finds himself on many planes and through many poles of his being. To each mode its purpose, to each plane or pole its fulfillment, both in the apex and the supreme scope of the eternal unity. It is necessarily through the individual self that we must arrive at the One, for that is the basis of all our experience. By knowledge, we arrive at identity with the One. For there is, in spite of the dualist, an essential identity by which we can plunge into our source and free ourselves from all bondage to individuality and even from all bondage to universality. Nor is the experience of that identity a gain for knowledge only, or for the pure state of abstract being. The height of all our action also, we have seen, is the immersion of ourselves in the Lord through unity with the divine will or conscious power by the way of works. The height of love is the rapturous immersion of ourselves in unity of ecstatic delight with the object of our love and adoration. But again, for divine works in the world, the individual self converts itself into a center of consciousness through which the divine will, one with the divine love and light, pours itself out in the multiplicity of the universe. We arrive in the same way at our unity with all our fellow beings, through the identity of this self with the Supreme and with the self in all others. Bhagavad Gita, chapter 13, shloka 17, and again, in the final chapter, the 18th, 54, just before the one I read to you a moment ago. When one has become the Brahman, when serene is the self, one neither grieves nor desires, when one is equal to all beings, then one gets the supreme love and devotion. At the same time, in the action of nature, we preserve by it as sole form of the One a differentiation which enables us to preserve relations of difference and oneness with other beings and with the Supreme Himself. Here's the beauty of the individual, that point through which universe and transcendence speak to each other, and through which all individuals can relate. There we have that point when the transversal meets the line coming down from above. Ah, that you are. The relations will necessarily be very different in essence and spirit from those which we had when we lived entirely in the ignorance, and oneness was a mere name or a struggling aspiration of imperfect love, sympathy, or yearning. Unity will be the law. Difference will be simply for the various enjoyment of that unity. Neither descending again into that plane of division which clings to the separation of the ego sense, nor attached to an exclusive seeking for pure identity which cannot have to do with any play of difference, we shall embrace and reconcile the two poles of being where they meet in the infinity of the highest. We'll pause there. We're about halfway through the chapter. Look where he leaves us at that pinnacle. A pinnacle upon which he stood in his personal example. Well, he writes about himself in Savitri also, never naming himself, never confessing that's who he is. But if he figures in the poem repeatedly, it is as Ashwapati. So let's look at Savitri tonight. Book 2, the book of the Traveler of the Worlds. Canto 1, The World Stare, celebrating both the life divine, the sevenfold court of being, and the modes of the self, and all of it brought to brilliant point in Sri Aurobindo's own person. Here we are. Alone he moved, watched by the infinity around him and the unknowable above. All could be seen that shuns the mortal eye. All could be known the mind has never grasped. All could be done no mortal will can dare. A limitless movement filled a limitless peace. In a profound existence beyond Earth's, parent or kin to our ideas and dreams, where space is a vast experiment of the soul, in an immaterial substance linked to ours, in a deep oneness of all things that are, the universe of the unknown arose. A self-creation without end or pause revealed the grandeurs of the infinite. It flung into the hazards of its play a million moods, a myriad energies, the world shapes that are fancies of its truth and the formulas of the freedom of its force. It poured into the ever-stable's flux a Bacchic rapture and revel of ideas, a passion and motion of everlastingness. There rose unborn into the unchanging surge thoughts that abide in their deathless consequence, words that immortal last though fallen mute, acts that brought out from silence its dumb sense, lines that convey the inexpressible. The eternal stillness saw in unmoved joy, his universal power at work display in plots of pain and dramas of delight, the wonder and beauty of her will to be. All, even pain, was the soul's pleasure here. Here, all experience was a single plan, the thousandfold expression of the One. All came at once into his single view. Nothing escaped his vast intuitive sight. Nothing drew near he could not feel as kin. He was one spirit with that immensity. Images in his supernal consciousness, embodying the unborn who never dies, the structured visions of the cosmic self, alive with the touch of being's eternity, looked at him like form-bound spiritual thoughts, figuring the movements of the ineffable. Aspects of being donned world outline, forms that open moving doors on things divine, became familiar to his hourly sight. The symbols of the spirit's reality, the living bodies of the bodiless, grew near to him, his daily associates. Let's read the rest of the passage tomorrow, next week. Next Sunday. Namaste. Jai Ma.